There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
And I'm like, other than being in shape and cut and having the stamina to paddle far enough out to catch sailfish on a kayak, we're basically the same person, honey.
Let's be, if you, this is what you're going to use. You might as well just grab like the towel bar out of your bathroom and tape a reel to it.
You have not honed your micro fishing skills and therefore will not survive.
It feels like they're trying to drag out the sound of the plastic slowly sliding from his nostril cavity.
Good morning, degenerate anglers. Welcome to Bent, the podcast that swears this is the year it's going to finally, once and for all, perfectly organize all its tackle and keep it that way so it's not constantly buying hooks, swivels, and soft plastics it knows it already has but can't find the night before a trip. How you like that one? I'm Joe Cermelli.
I'm Miles Nolte. And I don't believe in New Year's resolutions. But if I had one, it would be something along those lines about organizing tackle, because that's something I know I'd do.
Yeah, which honestly, is why it doesn't count.
I reorganize my tackle at least twice a year. It's this weird, like, zen therapeutic thing for me. It's especially true for fly boxes. There is something about a perfectly organized fly box that satisfies me and brings me some inner peace. I don't know why.
I could not agree more. But it's so rare that mine are organized. Like, I have to take a picture for social media because I'm like, wow, that only happens once a year. Because I do. I reorganize in the spring, and like the streamer box, say, we'll get all nice before the first warm season streamer trip. But by now, like, and I mean like right now in winter, my shit is chaos.
Yeah.
But I'm one of those people. Like, I got to say, I know where everything is, at least in the general sense of like what region of the garage,
what quadrant it should be in.
Yeah, what quadrant? It's in that quadrant.
Yeah.
But the only time I go nuts is when I jump into a curveball program, i.e., like I get invited on a random musky trip, you know, because I don't do that often. So finding and organizing all the musky lures and leaders that I have scattered about would take effort. But no, it does feel good in the spring when everything is perfectly in place.
Yeah, yeah. I can relate to much of what you're saying, and I feel like maybe I was misleading with my statement. So let me clarify. My shit is not organized, not by any stretch of the imagination in any sort of functional sense. Like, unlike you, I can't usually find what I need among the precarious stacks of gear that are just lining my garage. I don't do well with that. What I'm talking about is the small and useless act of organizing and reorganizing individual boxes. There's something
like the
about
battle, like, not the war. It's like the battle, not the war.
Like that I can, that feels like something I can handle. And so like I'll take all the lures or flies out and just kind of reorganize according to some system that I decided makes more sense this year. Like last year I decided that all the various prince nymphs that I have, like all the different kind of prince nymphs that I have, deserved their own box instead of just being thrown in.
You have a lot of them. I've seen them. I've seen you do have a lot of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, guiding out here, you kind of have to, right? And they used to just be lumped in with all the small stoneflies. But I was like, no, I've got enough. They deserve their own box. So I pulled them all out and reorganized everything. And will that help me find my prince nymphs or catch more fish? Absolutely not. I already knew where they were, but still I got a sense of joy out of it.
Yeah.
It was not useful, but it was joyful.
See, I don't own enough nymphs to organize them beyond the one standard size fly box that I have for nymphs. You know what I mean? Like if I broke them down further, we'd have like separate thimbles or something like that of nymphs. Anyway, look, I've got no problem with New Year's resolutions, okay? Just to get back to the opening point there. But if I make one, I won't tell anybody about it. Like, I have a problem with public posting of resolutions. Like, if you're going to do it, just shut up and do it for yourself. You know what I mean? Like, maybe, and I could be a jerk here and get flack for this. I don't know, but I never got that. Like, 1 week, smoke-free. You know, and 400 people are like, awesome job, bro. Keep it up. But then if any of those people see you burning a heater a week later outside the laundromat, now, like, they just know you have no follow-through. So why make that public, you know?
I'm sorry that I got that. I was slimmed down.
I think that's the point. I think, like, that's for people who need the social pressure to keep an agreement with themselves. And sure, great. I don't, I'm with you, man. I don't want other people judging me for choices I made about my own self and health or whatever. And like this whole conversation just has me thinking about last episode when we were talking about how New Year's kind of gets you down. And I've actually been thinking about that and wondering why it doesn't bum me out quite as much. And I think there are a couple answers. Like one, we have skiing out here, which makes the winter nicer, and that might be part of it. But the real answer, the thing that I've been thinking about is super deep and like mind-blowing. All right? Are you ready for this?
Do tell. Lay it on me.
The days are getting longer. For as dumb and obvious as that sounds, because it does. I think we sometimes forget that the whole point of having winter holidays are to keep us from losing our minds during the darkest days of the winter. And we made it. Those days are over.
Yep.
From now until June, every day is going to get just a little longer, just a little brighter, except for, you know, if you happen to be a listener in the Southern Hemisphere, I feel like you guys get really screwed on this whole deal. All the winter holidays happen in the middle of your summer, and then what do you have to get you through the dark, cold days of June?
I never thought about that.
International Day for the Fight Against Illegal, Unreported, and Unregulated Fishing?
That's not a real thing.
International Day of Yoga? World Seafarer Day? All those are actual UN-recognized June holidays. For the record, I looked it up. Anyway, for those of us who live in the top half of the globe, congratulations. We survived the darkest days of the darkest year in recent memory.
You know, amen to that. Yeah. Amen to that. I like where your head is at. Let's turn the page on this sumbitch. And from the view out of my social media feed, it looks like many of you are way ahead of us. And I'm seeing lots of pics of you guys getting out and having fun. And many of those pics have involved big coats and little rods. But maybe some of you dreamers out there, you have the coat. Like you figured out the coat part. But just need the perfect little rod to begin your hard water pursuits. Don't worry, Miles found a super sweet internet score for you in this week's sale bin.
Well, why did you put the head in the paper if you don't know what I'm getting at?
Well, you didn't have to be so hurtful with me, so angry.
Today, in the sale bin, we find a very simple offering. Whoever posted this particular gem on East Idaho Craigslist is not a person of many words. It's not someone that I would call verbose. They are into the whole brevity thing. The title is simple. Ice fishing poles. That's all it says.
There's a lot of things about this that are simple.
Very simple. All right, look. I am not an expert on ice fishing. I enjoy ice fishing. I have some ice gear. I get out when I can. I've worked on some ice fishing shows. I like grilling brats, drinking beer, and fishing through holes in the ice as much as the next guy, but I do not claim like solid expertise there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something I do.
Yep. I'm right there with you. I love it, but I don't have all the gear. I mooch off somebody else.
Yep. Yep. I mean, I feel like I know stuff, but I know enough to know that I'm not the guy who knows it all. But when I look at this post, even I know that something doesn't seem right. Because while I might not be the most experienced ice angler on the planet, I do know the difference between an ice fishing rod and a fly fishing rod. And what I see pictured in the two photos on this post are just the bottom sections of two very, very crappy fly rods with two very, very crappy fly reels. All right, just for context, picture the bottom section of a four-piece fly rod, the really thick part. Now picture that with a couple of snake guides attached and a tip top glued to the end of it. And you've got it. That is what is being sold.
You can't zoom in enough on the photo. Like even the tip guides, something looks weird about those. Like they were like a repurposed something else that was glued on the end.
I mean, there's a lot of creativity here, which I respect, but I think there's one major problem, right? Because so as far as I understand it, ice rods have two sort of basic essential qualities. One is that they're short so that you can jig over a hole without sitting 6 feet away from that hole. That yep. makes sense. And these fit that bill. They are short. You could do that. But the other thing that I expect from an ice rod is that it will be sensitive and have a pretty soft tip because you need to be able to detect a light strike and set the hook and fight a fish up through the ice without breaking pretty light line. And that's where this particular innovation, I think, falls short in that respect.
Yeah, it reminds me of a quote I believe that Gary Loomis once said, I can build you a rod that'll never break. You just won't want to fish with it.
Exactly. I mean, this is what you're going to use. You might as well just grab like the towel bar out of your bathroom and tape a reel to it. Like that would essentially perform the same function as either of these. It wouldn't look as cool, but it would do the same thing. So, all right. I respect the repurposing here, right? I mean, you got some old fly rods sitting around. You don't know what to do with them. You're like, I got an idea. Maybe I could turn it into an ice rod. But it didn't work. It clearly didn't work. And now someone's trying to sell that bad idea.
Yeah, I got to say, though, $10 for both?
And that's the thing.
If you needed a couple cheapo reels to knock around with, that's the deal of the century.
For sure. For sure. And honestly, not even that. That price for $10 for both, I would consider buying this set just to see the looks on my friends' faces when I like rolled into the ice shack and pulled out these little rods and started jigging with them. Like that would be worth $10 for me just to see that reaction. Like, what the hell is that? Oh, it's my new ice rod. You like it?
So the part that gets me is like, what do you do with this when you're in 80 feet of water jigging for giant Lakers? Like, you're just going to be standing there in front. There's no quick release on a fly reel, so you're just going to be sending a jig just, like, rant, 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 rant,
it off.
Rant, 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 for 45 minutes to get it down the depth. That's the major flaw. I can forgive the half a fly rod, but, like, stick a couple spinning reels on there, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, this is not functional.
It didn't work. You're trying to sell us your mistakes, which again, good on you. And at least it's cheap. So that one, man, I got a lot of laughs out of that. Whoever posted that in East Idaho, thank you. If you come across any online fishing gems for sale, just let us know. Send us a link to bent@themeateater.com. You all have been doing a great job sending us those submissions, and we do appreciate them. And we look forward to the next ones that you come up with.
So that's true. We have been getting a lot of good sailbin submissions lately. Several of you out there sent us a link to someone in Minnesota who's converting old beer taps into ice fishing rods. And while we didn't quite think that one had the legs for its own segment, it definitely deserves an honorable mention.
It's a good one. The only thing in that one that we can expand on, I particularly like the fact that they're priced not according to the quality of the rod blank or like the action or anything, but the price is according to how rare the beer tap is. Like the standard Bud Heavy tap goes for $60. But if you want the limited edition Busch Light corn cob tap, that's going to cost you a hundo.
Yeah. I mean, I think the rods are all just broken off ends of ugly sticks. So like there's no, one's not carbon, you know, versus, you know, whatever.
Definitely
it may
not.
Be. You know, priorities, dude, priorities. Someone also sent me one that was a set of matching beer tap rods, and I believe all the taps had little Montreal Canadiens goalie masks on top. Mm. You know, it's a whole set, and I'm sure it was Molson. Anyhow, whether people are out there using beer tap rods or normal rods, I have been seeing some stunner lake trout pictures lately, and I'm jealous, got to say, because lake trout are one of those fish that I rarely get to mess with them, but I love them and find them so fascinating.
Me too, definitely. I feel like a total dumbass when it comes to fishing for lake trout, because actually, I've only ever caught them by accident. I've never I've never targeted lake trout. But I know enough to know that the people who really get after them have it down to like a science. For there's that dude, the guy Grant Gully, who took Steve out on the last season of DOS Boat. And I've gotten to know Grant a little bit. And that guy, he's got the Laker game dialed. He's got it figured out.
Yeah, for sure. No, dude, one of the coolest things I ever did was I targeted them on the ice in Colorado with legendary guide Bernie Keefe. Awesome dude. And he said in the beginning, he's like, you want to catch a lot or you want to catch giants?
Hmm.
And I went with the latter. And in 2 days on the ice at Lake Granby, we only hit five fish, but they were all over 40 inches on giant tuna-sized soft plastics.
Really?
And to fight fish like that on a tiny rod, like scream and drag, it was insane. It was insane. And, you know, but of course, seeing where I live, I also have a soft spot for Great Lakes fish too, because they're one of the few fisheries that we've been able to successfully recover after we've, you know, pretty much damn near wiped them out. So I go up to the Great Lakes to fly fish for them, though I do understand most guys troll their Lakers, but I hate trolling.
Like, yeah, that's definitely how Grant gets them. He's a trolling guy.
Yeah. And I'm not a trolling guy. Like, if I never go on another billfish trip again, that'll be fine with me. And in fact, in today's Weekly Word, Miles is going to tell you what lake trout and billfish have in common.
Webster's Dictionary defines fish as...
This week's word is pelagic. No, not the apparel brand voted most likely to instigate a bar fight in the Fort Lauderdale Airport Chili's. Pelagic comes from the ancient Greek word pelagikos, meaning sea. For the purposes of us anglers, the term usually references the pelagic zone and pelagic fish. The pelagic zone describes the part of a body of water outside the tidal influence of a shoreline and not near any sort of bottom structure. Pelagic fish are fish that live, at least part of the time, in that open water. We're talking tuna, billfish, mahi, mackerel, sharks, rays, lake trout. Yeah, freshwater fish can be pelagic too if they live in a big enough lake. As well as the massive schools of bait fish on which those species feed. Herring, whiting, anchovy, jellyfish, flying fish, sardines, smelt, and lots of others. Still other popular fish migrate between the pelagic and coastal zones, like jacks, barracuda, redfish, and salmon. Point is, many of our favorite targets are at least partially pelagic. So if you like to fish, you might associate the term with abundance. Big fish, bloody decks, and full coolers. But the truth of the pelagic zone is very different. Pelagic actually describes the vast nothingness of open water, one of the most sterile and least hospitable places on the planet. Pelagic fish only make up 11% of the total fish species, though they live in the largest aquatic habitat on Earth. And here's the thing that a lot of us don't know. The pelagic zone is actually broken up into five different categories because open water isn't just broad, it's also usually deep. When us anglers talk about the pelagic zone, we're usually just referencing the surface layer, the epipelagic zone, which generally extends down about 650 feet depending on the clarity of the water. That's where the vast majority of sunlight, oxygen, energy, nutrients, and organisms are found, and not surprisingly, it's also where most of the fish live. But the pelagic zone goes a hell of a lot deeper than that. Below the epipelagic zone, you find the mesopelagic zone, meso being the Greek word for middle. This area goes down to about 3,300 feet and is also known as the twilight zone, because even though light does penetrate down that far, it's pretty diffuse. There's not enough sunlight at these depths for photosynthesis, so no plankton. Quite a few fish species do live down here, but they come up into shallow water to feed at night and hide in the depths during the day. Below this, you hit the bathypelagic zone, from the Greek word bathys, meaning deep. This extends from 3,300 feet down to 13,000 feet and is also called the dark or midnight zone because, duh, no light reaches down here. This is the zone where those creepy deep water fish that create their own bioluminescence and have ultra black light absorbing skin live. Check out Fish News from a few weeks ago for more details on these strange but fascinating adaptations. This zone is pretty damn inhospitable, at least from a terrestrial perspective. Aside from being completely dark, it's also cold, low in oxygen, and high in salinity and pressure. Fish down here survive either by eating the remains of shallower water fish that die and sink, or by eating each other. Next, you hit the abysso-pelagic zone, from the Greek abyssos, meaning bottomless. This goes from 13,000 feet down to nearly 20,000 feet, and is where many of the deepest oceans bottom out. But in certain places, like the Mariana Trench, the ocean goes to an even deeper zone, the Hado-pelagic zone, sometimes called the underworld, since Hado comes from Hades, the Greek god of the dead. We're talking about depths down to 36,000 feet, and honestly, we don't really know what lives in that zone because we can't get there. For me, like lots of other anglers, I think, the word pelagic conjures up images of early morning offshore runs, sinking the horizon, blow-ups in the bubble trail, trolling lines popping off outriggers, scrambling shouts of "fish on!", long sweaty stints in a fighting harness, prismatic flashes through blue water, and if you're lucky, a well-placed gaffer tag followed by high fives and cold beer. It's a word that we've appropriated to describe a particular kind of fishing. Big targets in open water. But the actual definition of pelagic doesn't fit that fantasy very well. It's a place of scarcity, a massive watery desert that includes the least comfortable parts of this planet. I don't exactly know what all this says about fishing culture. Maybe it reflects our optimism, our confidence that we can find the haystack needles that are pelagic fish. Maybe it just shows that we don't actually understand the English language all that well. Or maybe it speaks to the kind of native intelligence common among our kind. I know a lot of anglers who barely pass biology class by sitting tall behind the smart kids, but can recite exactly which buoys, fads, seamounts, and wrecks hold particular fish in any given conditions.
The one thing you got wrong, I believe Hank Parker fished the Hado pelagic zone well over a dozen years ago with flying lures.
Did
he? Spider wire. Yeah, it was all about the spider wire. It was right when spider wire came out, and it was like, you want to hit the Hado pelagic zone with, you know, spider wire.
I think you're going to need lead core for that.
Oh, yeah. I'm kidding. But going on what you said there, that's pretty much how I got through some of my science classes, dude. Like, I was never bold enough to blatantly cheat on the test, but I damn sure copied some homework. I also somehow ended up in AP Bio one year, and what I did in that situation was just simply fail.
I did not. I intentionally did not sign up for AP Bio because I knew that if I had, I would have either failed or cheated.
Yeah, I don't know why I did it. I really don't.
That was a bad choice. But unfortunately for us, there are no notes to steal or shoulders to peek over because it's just the two of us going mano a mano in Fish News.
Fish News!
That escalated quickly.
All right, so before we kick in the news, I do have one fan shout-out this week, and that's going to Tyler Berman, who emailed us, and the subject line of that email was, "Dude snorted a Senko." And I followed the Reddit link in this email to a video of a man getting a Senko removed from his nose by a doctor. Now, you watched this.
A doctor.
A doctor.
I'm using air quotes in my voice in case you couldn't tell. A doctor.
Okay, so all right, good. So you saw this too. You watched this too. And this isn't a news story we can officially use. It's not news. And I think the reason is because, as you've just hinted at, I'm calling total bullshit on the whole video. I'm calling it 100%
it's
fake.
It's gotta be bullshit, but I can't figure out why anyone would stage such an elaborate fake. It's not like, why?
I don't know. I don't know. And perhaps it's already been debunked. I don't know how long it's been around. But I don't think the doctor's real or anything because this dweeb is acting like he has a length of barbed wire jammed up his nose and they remove this Senko painfully slowly. Okay. With tweezers. Here's a bit of audio.
Oh man. Oh, sorry. It's just so, it just feels so weird. Sorry.
Can you give me that light, please?
Yeah.
And then later, a little bit later, here's this.
Okay, you're doing good. You're doing great.
Okay.
And I don't know if you read the comments, man, but most of them were saying what I was thinking, which was just pull it out.
Yeah.
Why are we extracting this?
Why is this going 1 centimeter at a time? Like it feels like one of those, I don't know if I'm going to say this right, those, is it ASMR videos? The weird, like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It feels like they're trying to drag out the sound of the plastic slowly sliding from his nostril cavity. Like, I don't get it.
First of all, Senkos are lubricated out of the package, man. Like, if I had
well, that's
I had
how we got it up
between,
there.
Yeah. If I had a choice between a Senko or like a Bic pen jammed up my snooter, I'd take the Senko every time.
Every time.
And also, like when it finally wiggles out, it's oddly void of boogers. So I'm calling this fake, right? But Tyler, we appreciate you sending it, man.
I'm going to say one more thing. But if you watch this video, like it is very elaborately staged. There's like a very doctor-seeming actor in a coat and a lat. Like, they spent some time and some effort and some resources making this, and I cannot understand why. So
And not that I expect many people to like, just know this off the top of their head, but the guy who's getting it pulled out of his nose looks like the lead singer of Mudhoney.
He does. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but you're absolutely right.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. So that's my fan shout-out. Tyler, thank you.
I mean, I've got my little early one, and I'm not going to shout anybody out by name on this one, and it'll make sense in a second, but it does connect to that in sort of the shape of the bait. A lot of people lately have reached out to us with links to lures in the shape of penises. And I got to admit that I was totally ignorant of this, like, propensity that anglers seem to have for casting out phallic lures and trying to get fish to eat them. I had no idea that was a thing, man. We've gotten links to crankbaits, stick baits, soft plastics, all molded to look like male members.
I know where you're going, though, here. So we've gotten a lot of links to ones that are pre-made for sale. Are you going to the gentleman that made his own?
I'm not calling him out, but is one of the ones.
Yeah.
That is one of the ones. And yeah. I'm not going to...
He sent us an email. He said, I got a 3D printer for Christmas, and I made this top water, and it's a penis and nuts. And like in my head, I'm like, why did you make that? And furthermore, why did you send that to
us? That's where I'm going. Where I'm going is I don't get it. Like, is this some weird desire to debase the fish? Is it like some kind of like dominance thing? I don't know. I just don't get it.
I don't believe anybody's using those wiener lures. It's just like, it's like a joke you buy for your friend, but it was funny 30 years ago. Like, these are not new. Like, you've been able to buy booby and wiener lures forever. You just had to do it, you know, through mail order instead of on Facebook. But
it's like the Spencer's Gifts of the fishing world. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much. So I think what we're both saying is we love seeing weird stuff from you guys, but you can stop with the dick lures. Like, we're not doing a sale bin on the dick lures.
Nope.
We're not sharing your homemade dick lures on Instagram, which I don't know why you'd want us to do that anyway. You know, anyway.
Oh, anyway, I had that one, like, they keep coming. So I felt like they had to be addressed. Let's move on to some fish news and maybe something of a little more substance here.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So I get to kick off this week. As a reminder, as always, this is a competition. Miles and I don't know what stories the other guys bring to the table. And Madman Audio Engineer Phil will declare a news victor at the end. And I'm going to start off today with a nod to a buddy of mine, Jason Nark, who's a journalist of the highest caliber, exquisite writer. And I met Jason 2 summers ago. He was working on a piece about snakeheads on the Delaware River watershed for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And he tagged along with me on a snake hunt. Now, this is a caveat that has nothing to do with the story. I just have to tell it, right? I just have to bring it up. At the time I met Jason, he was a very clean-cut, well-pressed man. And then last summer, I'm snakehead fishing on the side of the road in South Jersey. And up pulls this pickup with a kayak stashed in the back. And out pops a long-haired, very unshaven Jason wearing like a full-brim boonie hat. And like he's all sweaty. And it turned out he became so snakehead obsessed, he now spends his summers just mucking around the swamps of South Jersey. And
Another life ruined by Joe Cermelli.
But tell you what, Jason is still writing and writing very well. And he recently had a story in the New York Times headlined, "The Problem with Problem Sharks." Okay. And I'm going to summarize a lot of this because it's a long one, right? But here's the gist. I think we all know what shark culls are. Okay. Shark bites a swimmer, causes mass hysteria. And in the past, even here in the US, That would lead to the killing of a bunch of sharks in the area of the attack, right? With the idea being you're getting rid of the problem one, okay? Now, while these full-on bloodbaths don't happen like they used to, in other countries, particularly South Africa and Australia, they do still use nets and baited hooks time to time. They're still deployed along some beaches where swimmers and large numbers of sharks often mingle. So there's a doctor, Dr. Eric Clua, C-L-U-A. It's French. I don't know how to pronounce. Do you know how to pronounce Clua?
Nope, not even going to try.
Clua. We're just going to call him Dr. Clua, okay? And he's a marine biologist based in Paris, and he says he's figured out how we can get away from shark calls, which, as the story says, is like executing everyone in a police lineup in order to ensure justice was dispensed on the guilty party. Now, I'm going to quote from Jason's story here. Fascinating. Dr. Clua said he has found a way to make precision strikes on sharks that have attacked people through a form of DNA profiling he calls bite printing. And he believes it's usually just solo, quote, problem sharks that attack humans repeatedly, analogizing them to terrestrial predators that have been documented behaving the same way. Instead of culling every bear, tiger, or lion when only one has serially attacked people, wildlife managers on land usually focus their ire on the culprit. Dr. Clua said that problem sharks could be dispatched the same way. And once a database of these bite prints is built, DNA could be collected from the wounds of people who were bitten by sharks and matched to a known shark. The offending shark would then need to be found and killed.
Okay.
Okay? With me so far?
I'm with you. I have a couple questions, but I'm going to let you finish in case you answer.
So many other people in the science field have poo-pooed this idea. And I don't necessarily mean the bite printing part, right? It seems most agree that collecting DNA, via bite print could work, right? And Clua is perfecting the technique using tiger sharks in French Polynesia. And here's a quote. He says, "I'll let them bite a pig leg or something else with flesh, muscle, and bone." And that's what he's using to perfect this DNA collection from a bite wound. But many people are saying, first of all, the idea of a rogue Jaws-like problem shark has been long debunked. Like, there's really no science that proves that's a real thing. Clua is saying, on the other hand, his research and data collection will prove the opposite, that problem sharks do exist. But, I mean, here's where we get our fishy tie-in, right? What this guy fails to address in this, even though other sources who aren't even anglers have addressed it very loudly in the piece, is, okay, like, let's say this data collection proves there's a problem shark that's bitten three people. How do you now single it out and target it? That's just
that was my question. Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Like, how do you know which one it is from the DNA?
He doesn't address that at all, right? And that's just not how fishing works. So if I'm understanding this right, like, theoretically, a great white could bite someone in, say, Cape Cod. And by the time you get the data back, assuming that there's a pool of data, right? Like, I imagine that shark would have had to have bitten other people.
At least two people.
Right, at least two people for proper data to be collected. And then you take the time to determine, oh, yeah, that's the problem shark. It could be 120 miles off Jersey in 500 feet of water. Like, you can't just take a boat out in the ocean and say, I want that one. So in my opinion, this is just a case of hardcore science not jiving with simple common sense. Like, in my head, it like teeters on ridiculous. It's like saying, new study finds serial killers drive cars. Well, yeah, but like that doesn't help us find them. So
I tend to give researchers the benefit of the doubt in these things. Not always right, but they're generally pretty like smart folks who understand complex problem solving. So
right.
I would love to be able to ask this guy, like, what's your solution, man? Like, okay, you've got the DNA of a problem shark. How do you, there are 500 sharks in this area. How do you tell which one is the one without killing all of them or sampling all? Like, I don't get it.
No, you're right. But even if you could tell which one, how do you target that shark in a pack of, I just don't see. I don't see how that would ever work. I don't doubt that hypothetically that database could be created, but in my opinion, it would take a damn long time. Like we were saying, in order to identify one of those sharks, wouldn't it have to bite multiple people, and you'd have to have the DNA from multiple people?
I mean, you could. What it would do? Here's what I'll say: it would prove or disprove the idea of problem sharks. And so, like, if that's what we're going for here, You could say like, oh, this person and this person and this person were all bit. It's the same shark.
Okay. Yeah, but even that, man, I don't know. I could counter argue that and say that, like, if you look at the New Jersey attacks from close to shore, the book I did on Philistines mm-hmm. here, there's a million theories as to why those sharks were there doing that. And in a lot of cases, they point to environmental things. It's not like those fish were blood hungry for humans. They were where they weren't supposed to be or got pushed there because of weather factors, or, you know, they ran out of a food source here. Like, what is a problem shark?
Okay, but regardless of the reason why they get there, you could say the same thing about bears, in that, and we do have problem bears. There are usually environmental factors that drive a bear to seek an alternate food source that maybe become human-based, whether it's human food or people.
Yeah.
But once that's happened, then that bear is a problem.
I see.
And it will continue to seek out that food source. And so that's where I would say it could be valuable.
Okay. All right. Well,
I still don't know how you find the shark. All you do is be like, yep, they're a problem. I think we'd have to figure something else out off of that. Yeah.
There's a lot more work to be done here, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot more work to be done.
And on the kind of on the subject of areas of fisheries management where we have a lot of work to do, I'm going to pivot from the salt to the fresh here. And, you know, in previous fish news segments, we've talked quite a lot about the detrimental impact of fertilizer, specifically mm-hmm. phosphorus on water quality, right? And just a little quick update, nutrients from fertilizer used in lawns, golf courses, and agriculture get into waterways and then concentrate in lakes and then cause algae blooms, which lead to all kinds of problems, right? Like oxygen depletion, cyanobacteria. These are things we've talked about. And this is a major and growing problem in fisheries across the globe, right? You think about the massive red tides and fish kills in Florida, or the blue-green algae warnings that seem to be just growing in scope and scale every summer all over the place. So in light of all that, here's my question on this story. Why is a ranch on Colorado's Blue River requesting permits to intentionally add phosphorus to the river? And why do some conservation groups and environmental advocates support the idea? All right, so I'm gonna give you a little backstory here so we can put this together.
I'm not supposed to answer yet, am
no,
I?
No, you're not supposed to answer. I'm just set. That was hypothetical, rhetorical.
All right.
Not in a hypothetical, rhetorical. All right, first, a little backstory. The Blue River cuts through the mountains of central Colorado on the west side of the Continental Divide. In the 1960s, as Colorado's Front Range population began to expand, city planners realized that they didn't have enough water to support the number of people they were hoping to attract into these metropolitan areas east of the divide. We're talking about Denver, Colorado Springs, Pueblo, Fort Collins. So they devised massive pipeline projects to divert water through the mountains from the wetter western side to the drier east side, where all the people want to live because it's warm and sunny.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The backstory on these water diversion projects is like fascinating in and of itself. It's worthy of its own segment, but I ain't got time for all that right now. I just need to give you the basics. What's important here is that the Blue is one of the rivers that gets diverted, moving water from the Dillon Reservoir over to the South Platte River and therefore Denver. Dillon Reservoir sits above a 231-foot high bottom release dam, meaning that the water flowing out of that dam into the Blue River below comes from the lower reaches of the water column. So it remains at a relatively constant temperature that's optimal for trout, never getting too hot in the summer or too cold in the winter. Just about every famous trout fishery in the U.S. sits below a bottom release dam for exactly that reason. And the Blue has long been a famous trout fishery. It's known for producing just massive rainbows and big browns too. Part of the reason that fishery has remained so healthy is that in the 1980s, as the mountain towns grew in the upper Blue River Basin, water quality managers enacted very strict regulations on wastewater discharge, which kept levels of pollutants, including phosphorus, pretty low. For several decades, the Blue was arguably one of the best trophy trout rivers in Colorado and the country, really. Guides and outfitters proliferated and profited, and private ranches were bought up along the banks, creating exclusive access for their owners and clientele. One of those ranches, Blue Valley Ranch, owns a stretch so noted for its big fish that local anglers refer to it as Jurassic Park. Okay, so now fast forward to 2016. Colorado Parks and Wildlife stripped a 19-mile stretch of the Blue, which includes the Jurassic Park section, of its gold medal status because they found that the size and number of trout in the river had significantly declined. Biologists explained that the water lacked nutrients. So basically, many of the nutrients flowing into the system were getting trapped in Dillon Reservoir and not making their way through the dam. Low nutrients means few aquatic plants, which means low numbers of aquatic insects, which means no food for trout.
Yeah.
So this year, Blue Valley Ranch, a 25,000-acre swath of land, which, again, houses that Jurassic Park section, wants to pilot a program that would intentionally add nearly 2,000 gallons of phosphorus to the river annually in order to boost nutrient levels and, hopefully, fish size and populations. Now, this could sound like an evil plot by a rich landowner to improve the fishing on his private stretch of river at the expense of the ecosystem, but it's not actually that simple. Paul Tudor Jones II, who owns the ranch, the dude, he's actually proven himself to be like a pretty good steward of the land and the water and the wildlife. He's spent a lot of his money trying to improve habitat. He built these wildlife corridors to get through the busy highway near there so that there were less issues. He set up a foundation that works to protect the mangroves in Florida. And he's done a ton of stream habitat restoration on the Blue, which not only benefits him, but all the anglers that fish that river. So various local conservation groups and water planning organizations are backing this project. That includes Trout Unlimited, the Blue River Watershed Group, and the Colorado Basin Roundtable. And they're hoping that this has the potential to rehabilitate this section of the river. But what I wonder, like, what does rehabilitation really mean here? Yeah. We're talking about an artificial system that's been dammed and redirected and planted with completely non-native fish that grow to disproportionately large sizes. Sarah Marshall, an eco-hydrologist with the Colorado Natural Heritage Program at Colorado State University, she sees value in the Blue Valley Ranch's experiment, but said further tinkering with the river to restore it could have risks. She told the Aspen Times, "The proposed study sounds like a Band-Aid rather than fixing the underlying causes of degraded stream habitat." And I got to say, man, I'm as I so often am, I'm torn on this one. I fished the Blue, and it's an incredible fishery. Like, it's amazing. And I hate to see a section of stream lose its fish, particularly one that's as good as that one. But I'm also not totally comfortable with intentionally adding phosphorus to a river when we're working so hard to limit the nutrient load in so many of our waters, right? It might help that 20-mile stretch that's lacking nutrients, but then just add to the problem downstream, right? It seems like one of those situations where we've completely screwed up a natural system and we're just going to keep doing more and more tinkering, thinking that like screwing it up further will fix what we've already done. But projects like that don't really have a great track record. So it's a tough one, man.
Yeah, man. And it's a hard one for me to speak to because I certainly know the Blue. I've never fished it. I mean, I'm not that in tune with that particular river. But you can't help but see both sides of it. I mean, without knowing what the vegetation in there looked like, I mean, that is important. And forget all the pollution and conservation. I mean, you get a high water year here on the river, and then the grass doesn't grow. The fishing sucks in certain spots. Like, you do need that. And sometimes I also think that you can overprotect something because, I mean, if you look at something like this that was so special in Blue Ribbon, how many great trout streams out there are not protected nearly as much as this one is? I mean, especially like I look at Pennsylvania, there's a lot of great trout streams in Pennsylvania that, I mean, they're not coddled the way some of these Western fisheries are. There's all kinds of shit dumping into them and they still fish and they have big fish in them. And so I'm not saying you can't do anything, but I mean, I don't have a firm answer on that either. Cause I see the value both ways.
But I mean, this was not a trophy trout stream initially, right? Originally, if we're talking about what it used to be, it was it used to be probably a pretty good cutthroat stream, but no one really knows because there was so much mining activity in that area in the 1800s. It basically killed everything off.
Right.
And then in the 1960s, they built this dam to send water over to Denver, which created this bottom release fishery that grew these massive trout. And for 40 years, it was great. And then they ran out of nutrients. It's not great anymore. So, I mean, what are we fixing? What are we trying to restore?
Yeah, you're fixing something that was manufactured from the get-go.
Right.
Really. essentially.
And I get it. Like, I love big trout streams too. I love bottom release dams. I love tailwaters. They're some of my favorite places to fish. But is it worth potentially adding more phosphorus load to the greater Colorado River system that could mess things up downstream just to have that one piece go back to what it was for a very short period of time?
The correct answer to that is probably not. I mean, probably not. But I mean, dude, you know how anglers are, man. It's like people care most about where they're fishing and how it affects what they want to do. And I mean, that's a problem with so many conservation issues, is we're worried about right here and now and not 50 miles from here. I mean, it happens all the time.
And look, I get it. A lot of people make their living guiding that river, and I'm not trying to say that their needs aren't serious or significant. I'm really not. I just, it's a hard one. It's complicated.
It's a very hard one. I don't think we'll necessarily resolve it here. But by all means, email us, weigh in. We'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly, and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself. And you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
And how do I segue this? Well, hopefully it'll get back to a status of some serious meat-eating trout, gigantic meat eaters, which is that's a shit segue. But
I just want to see where it goes now. Like you're really building it up.
Well, here's where it's going to go, because this is a fun one that's ironically going to pair perfectly with this week's closing end of the line segment. So stay tuned for that. But you'll know where that's going as soon as I read this headline here from Louisiana Sportsman. Two catfish eat family of ducks. Okay. So nice. this pair of blue cats was caught by angler Nick Price near Houma, and the fish weighed 19 and a half and 20.2 pounds. So definitely respectable blue cats, right? But not like super tanker monsters either. And according to the story, Nick noticed the guts on these cats were abnormally distended. So after filleting, he slit open the stomachs and outpoured a whole family of ducks.
Wow.
Okay. And Nick says one cat was full of just babies. The other one had one baby and the mama duck. So like the full grown duck, right?
These can't be mallards. That's all I'm going to say. There's no way these are got to be a smaller duck. And so, sorry. Anyway,
I'm going to throw a shot up on the on our weekly Bent Insta story so you guys can see it. They're pretty. You could tell they're ducks. They're kind of decomposed, and I'm not a bird person. I don't know what they are, but one is definitely a full grown duck. Okay.
Wow.
Because that's what I thought. Like babies, I understand. But the mama duck, that's impressive, especially considering these were not 40, 50-pound blue cats. Like 20 is good, but it's not insane. No. So Nick reckons the fish were paired up and swimming around together when they happen upon the Ducksworth family here. And he says he showed this, the pictures of the stomach contents, to his dad and uncle, and they've both been catfishing this area for 50 years and said they'd never seen anything like that. Now, remember that part right there as you venture into the end of the line segment. 50 years, the local cat crew had never seen anything like this. That'll be important again later. But Nick says he did do some research and found some video of catfish taking shots at ducks and other birds, which I've seen them. Wells catfish over in Europe in particular, yeah. Right? But I don't think Nick's going to start baiting with duck parts. He did, however, add, and I'm quoting here, "I have an unusual catfish bait. It only catches big catfish. It won't catch a lot. But you catch bigger ones with more meat than five small ones." His secret? Speckled trout belly. Now, he says it's prime catfish bait. They love it. I've been using it here for at least 3 years. My biggest catch has been about 38 pounds. Nick, like, what? Just ride on the ducks, man. Like, why are you going to give your shit away like that?
Yeah. You know there's a chance that we're going to tell it to everybody. But,
yeah.
You know.
I mean, we kind of just did. So, I just thought that was an interesting little one. You know, the birds pop up now and again, the mice and the voles and the things and the trout stomachs. But I don't ever recall seeing a whole family of ducks in blue cat stomachs before.
No, I haven't. I've never caught a blue cat, so I can't speak to it. But no.
Oh, really?
I've never caught a blue. I know.
That.
I've caught lots of other cats, but I've never caught a blue. I sort of, for my second story today, I also went a little bit more like lighthearted and fun.
It's okay.
Not quite so sciencey and serious. You know, but like you, you know, you went salt into fresh and I went fresh and now into salt. So we're getting a whole smattering of everything.
Great.
And I'll admit my first story was really long. So the second one's going to be pretty short. I got to close with the best headline. And that's purely why I picked the story. The best headline I found all week. Fish sex organs boosted under high CO2. And this one came from fizz.org, one of those science journalism websites that I enjoy just like hanging around on. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to file this in the very, very slim category of benefits of climate change. So a new study out of the University of Adelaide found that one particular species of reef fish looks like it may actually benefit from ocean acidification, you know, that's happening right now as a result of increased CO2 in the atmosphere. The common triple fin, or Forstergion lapillum, I know I blew that, is a shallow water species found off the coast of New Zealand. When exposed to increased levels of oceanic acidity, these fish produce more sperm and eggs and take better care of their fertilized ova. The research team compared the triple fin found in areas of underwater volcanic seeps that naturally have high levels of carbon dioxide with fish found outside those areas. And they discovered that those fish experienced no negative effects from acidification and significant increase in gonad production. The males in the area of high acid ate and foraged more, and the females devoted more of their energy to ovarian production. The researchers also found that the males spent more time and energy guarding the fertilized eggs, which might lead to better recruitment. So there's the good news in all this. The bad news is that we're talking about tide pool fish that grow to a whopping 8 centimeters. So like, I don't think you're going to look for the triple fin to take the place of your favorite sport fish, which are not going to fare so well from acidified oceans. But hey, something's going to do all right.
I don't even know what to say about that. I was thinking that maybe they were like a different version of the triple tail.
I know. You know what I mean?
I was like, ooh.
Ooh, like a, no. We were talking about tiny little tide pool fish that, that will do great when everything else dies.
Here's what I'll say about that. I once did an interview with a very smart gentleman who wrote a very great book about microfishing. And I was like, what is all this about? And it was a very interesting conversation. But one of the things that he said is like, you know, micro fishermen might be laughing all the way to the bank because at some point, like, that might be what's left. And then you have not honed your micro fishing skills and therefore will not survive. So don't joke. You never know.
I don't know what we're gonna be fishing for in 30 years or what's gonna be the thing that makes me most excited. It might be a whopper. I got an 8-centimeter, bro.
Yeah, but
this
at the same time,
fin,
man,
is huge.
Like when are we gonna get like the you know, some climate change thing produces 10-pound bluegills? You know, like we've been hearing about that our whole life, like the radioactive, like we're gonna get some of that. You know,
well, at least one fish seems like he's going to benefit from it. So maybe others will too. Who knows? We'll all find out soon enough.
We can only hope. Either we clean up the whole climate and the whole thing, or we just hope for, like, you know, stupid radioactive fish. Phil's got a lot to take in here. We got sexual fish organs, duck sauce,
catfish with duck sauce.
Catfish, yeah, Miracle-Gro. Sprinkle a little Miracle-Gro in your favorite trout stream. And shark hunting. Phil, let us know what you're thinking, man. We'll see which way you sway this week. And as soon as we're done hearing from you, it's on to Awkward Moments in Angling.
Quack, quack. Joe Cermelli, you are the winner this week. Also, I just wanted to ask you guys for a favor for a friend of mine. If you guys come across any news stories about how increased CO2 levels can improve the performance of human sex organs or anything, it doesn't have to be CO2, go ahead and pass those stories along to me and I'll forward them on to my friend for, you know, no reason. Thanks.
Why don't you take a picture? It'll last longer.
So I want to say I feel bad about what we're about to do here, but I don't.
No, you don't.
I can't feel bad because you guys send us shots to trash. Like, you guys opt into this. You put the shit talk ball squarely in our court and you say things like, here's a picture, destroy me. So I can't feel too bad because those are the emails that we get.
No guilt at all.
Exactly. Right. But I'm going to enjoy this one a little more than usual because today's awkward moment, awkward photo is from a friend of mine. And today we're going to deconstruct a photo of this pal, or maybe former pal, Kevin Hughes. And when he sent this shot, he didn't even provide a backstory. He was basically like, hey, you said you were looking for awkward shots. Here you go. That's what I got from Kevin.
Yeah. I don't know Kevin at all, but I feel zero issue with trashing this one because awkward it is.
Yep.
Again, I don't know this guy, but I'm going to go ahead and say that Kevin is either just incredibly self-confident, like just one of those people who's automatically comfortable in their skin no matter how they look, or totally unaware of what he was getting into when he offered up the shot.
Well, I can tell you that he's totally confident now because a quick bit of backstory on Kev. I've known him for years, and he lives down in Miami, and you can find him on the Instagram at Small Craft Advisory Fishing, which is a very clever name considering his shtick is kayak fishing. And he produces all kinds of cool videos and social media and even guides a bit. But when I say kayak fishing, I mean like giant tarpon and snook and tuna and all kinds of macho stuff. Like, he gets after it. Kevin's not at the golf course pond. You know what I mean? And while I don't have time to explain why, I also believe he's one of the luckiest anglers on the planet. I have joked with mutual friends more than once that he has a horseshoe stuck up his ass. So good for him. He's lucky. Kevin is also a gorgeous man. Like, no kidding. Over the years, my own wife has been like, OMG, Kevin Hughes is so hot. And I'm like,
that
other
hurts.
Than being...
That stings.
Yeah.
Because it's not like a famous celebrity. It's a buddy.
And I'm like, other than being in shape and cut and having the stamina to paddle far enough out to catch sailfish on a kayak, we're basically the same person, hon. You know?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure she agrees with that. You guys, other than his like seemingly chiseled physique, his southern location, and his badass jackalope tattoo. You guys are basically twins.
We are. But then Kevin had to go send us this photo of him in April 2001, standing on the shore of a Colorado lake, and I don't even know where to begin, but I guess I'll start here. 14-year-old Kevin was not so cut, not at all. And let's just say he was likely familiar with Oxy or Stridex pads, okay? And look, I was too. I'm not making fun of that. I'm just, we're stating facts about the photo,
yep,
pointing things out, and I felt the need to go there.
No, I think it's earned, and I also feel like I got to say, I was an Oxy guy myself, and for the youngins out there who grew up in the big pharma generation, we're talking about astringent acne pads, all right? Not hillbilly heroin. But I'm not one to pick on a little kid's pimples. I'd consider that a low blow. I will reserve my ridicule for the clothes that his mom probably bought for him. And young Kevin's mom seems like she had good taste, because his attire is, what's the adjective? Stunning. It's stunning. I'm dying to get into that shirt, but I will start at the top. I will hold back. Kevin is wearing a white Abercrombie visor, which leads me to believe that he was either the last preppy kid still wearing Abercrombie in 2001, or he was really into Eminem. And I hope it was the latter. Like, I hope that when he wasn't fishing, he was just watching 8 Mile on repeat and daydreaming about himself winning rap battles. I'm going to say, strong chance there were Slim Shady posters in his room.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. You mentioned the shirt. The shirt sort of backs that up. Okay. Yeah. This shirt, it's loose, flowy, and breathable, button up like a Hawaiian shirt, but it's got this crazy Asian print happening, right? And I mean, it's all over the place. It's a white shirt, but it's just slathered with Chinese letters and dragons, just all different color dragons, man, like randomized all over the shirt.
I hate to interrupt you, but I'm pretty sure that when I saw Wu-Tang play in Hawaii, one of them was wearing that shirt.
Oh, you saw Wu-Tang?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, man. All right, we can't get off on that now, but there you go. So that's actually, you just made the shirt cooler and kind of ruined the whole make fun of it thing. But anyway, I look at it and I'm like, well, this is kind of foreshadowing, right? Because I was like, it's kind of a little bit Scarface, and Kevin did end up moving to Miami. You know what I mean? So it's like, yep, a little picture of the future, like what he's going to rock and you know where he lives. But can't you see him at the mall with his friends falling in love with that shirt? Like, what, you know, while there were no adults there, like I bought, you know, weird clothes and stuff, you know, when I was at the mall with my friends, and my dad, you know, had a pair of JNCOs. My dad would be like, what the hell are you wearing? Bell bottoms? You know, it happened all the time.
I mean, yes, I can relate to that, but the shirt does not flag that way for me. It just, okay, like, I think we have different perspectives on that shirt. The Asian themed Hawaiian shirt just doesn't throw me at all. I can actually picture some, I think some of my high school teachers wore that shirt in the late 90s, if I'm being honest. And I would probably still rock that shirt to this day.
I could see you wearing, you know what? Damn it. I could see you wearing that shirt.
Yeah, I could too.
To a Christmas party or something.
Yeah, totally. Or just out fishing on a summer day. It could happen. I will admit that the shirt feels a little out of place, like with the backdrop of the Colorado high mountain lake. So, yeah, I see how it's a little out of place there, but I can't throw too much shade because I could see myself doing that. But let's move off the shirt. Let's move on to the fish.
Yes.
Kevin's holding a small rainbow trout. And it's not like, when I say small, we're not talking like 4 inches of fury small. It's also not what I would put into the hog category.
No.
Right? Let's call it a 12-incher. It's a perfectly respectable fish for a 14-year-old kid to get excited about. He could have used maybe a little guidance on the hold, like maybe loosen up the full hand around the gills death grip. But again, I've seen worse. It's not the worst I've seen.
Yeah. See, we may disagree here, but like what strikes me is the look on his face, right? A face, by the way, that's wearing glasses that I don't recall being in style. Okay. Just they're these no. thin gold framed oblong, not sunglasses. These are like glasses. That I don't feel matches age. It's like he's trying to find his own style with the ensemble, with the clothing. But like these are the glasses like his mom bought him 6 years earlier that he's still wearing. Okay. But anyway, I don't think the ensemble belongs in this fishy setting. And his face to me looks as though someone else caught the trout and handed it to him and said, can you hold my trout for a sec, dude? And then like before he could respond and say, I don't know how to hold a fish, someone quickly snapped his photo.
Snap.
That's what I see.
I get that. The thing that sticks out for me on that one is just his apparent total lack of enthusiasm, right? And it doesn't come off like the I'm too cool to look excited, aloof teenager thing, which I would understand for a 14-year-old. It doesn't feel like that. It feels strangely more wholesome. Like if I were to caption this photo, it would say something like, hey, this fishing stuff is pretty neat. Like that's...
Would you say it like the moose from Wally World?
This fish is a pretty neat one. But my big takeaway from the photo is that I'm looking at someone who has no business being as comfortable and confident in his body as he seems to be. Like, I don't know how he can have that look of confidence and be the 14-year-old kid that he is. And it seems like, man, I gotta say, it seems like it's all worked out for him. Because you say Kevin has sprouted into an absolute angling badass.
He has.
And my final point here is that this picture should provide hope to all the mid-puberty kids out there stuck somewhere between wanting to be KVD and, I don't know, what's cool, Post Malone. Depending on and they're like trying to make the decision based on what they think is going to get them more attention from the people that they're interested in romantically. But here's a hint for all of you. It's always the musician and never the fisherman. Always. Oh, yeah. Just plain simple.
You'll mac it so much more being a drummer in a Def Leppard cover band, you know, especially considering you have two arms, than like winning the Bassmaster Classic.
It's true.
But listen, there is a video of Kevin out there paddling under 10 docks with a 40-pound snook on the line, passing his rod around pilings 12 times, and you're watching this go, and there's no way this dude is landing this fish. But he does. Amazing angler. Hughes, you're an American badass. And we do thank you for sending this, okay? And to everyone else, if you're dying to be this embarrassed on our podcast, please keep those shots coming to bent@themeateater.com.
You know, I gotta say, Kevin's story, the life story of his that you laid out there, kind of makes me think of the fairy tale, The Ugly Duckling. You remember that one?
Of course I do. It's classic.
Yeah, I feel like when I was a kid, I got the modern, like watered down version of that original story. Because I was looking this up, something to do with like getting my kid new books, and the original by Hans Christian Andersen. And it's like so many other classic fairy tales. It's so much more brutal than the stuff the kids get nowadays. Like, it's a nice little fun story.
No, totally, man. Like, my daughter's really into The Little Mermaid. And I you know, Disney, the whole deal. And But I found out, much to my surprise, not long ago, that was originally a Hans Christian Andersen tale. I did not know that. And in his book, in order to walk on land, she had to drink a potion that made her feel like she was constantly walking on knives.
Oh,
I mean, how terrible is that? And then after enduring all that pain, the prince marries another gal and the Little Mermaid kills herself. So they left that out of the musical, you know?
And we
didn't
want
to be part of that world, you know?
Oh, that was good. That was good. Yeah, I mean, you look at that stuff and then we wonder why we're bitching about the fact that kids are softer nowadays than they were in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I didn't mean to derail us into talking about gory fairy tales and sensitive children. I was really trying to set up a nice little segue there because for End of the Line, Joe is going to tell us about some ugly ducklings whose entire purpose in life is to elicit violence.
Fishy, 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 fishy!
Well, that's not loud enough, Bert.
Tracing the history of any style of lore to its true origins is often pretty difficult. The first frog lures, as an example, were likely whittled in a backwoods cabin and crushing fish long before the world was introduced to the rubber snag-proof frog. In many cases, a lure's story starts when either the inventor or someone with more business savvy than the inventor begins mass production, and such is the case with the first duckling lure. I went down quite a rabbit hole trying to get a bead on the first duckling to hit tackle shop shelves, and to the best of my research, it was the Cree duck, spelled C-R-E-E, D-U-K. Multiple, kind of reliable sources have its mass production starting in the 1950s. That mass production happened in the town of Oregon, Ohio, and the Cree duck was the brainchild of Mr. Bill Szabo. The Cree duck was made of molded plastic and looks exactly, precisely, like a classic bathtub rubber ducky. The bait has a flat bottom, and it's through-wired with one big old honking treble hook dangling behind the ass region. On either side of that hook, two more wires create little duckling legs, each with a small silver spinner blade at the end. Cree ducks, at least per eBay, were available in classic black and yellow, black and white, and even white and cinnamon. Though Zabo was eventually bought out by a larger manufacturer, it seems as though the Cree duck was made through at least the 1970s. What's most interesting about it, however, is its origin, which I learned about from a single magazine ad I found online from the 1960s that appears to be written by Zabo himself. Across the top it reads, "Indian Guide Tells All. Now you can use his secret to catch big fish." Having fished the Cree River system in northern Canada, I knew right away he was talking about the Cree Indians, hence the lore name. The ad says nobody could figure out how the Cree guides were managing to consistently catch stringers of massive pike, which is silly, because I know for a fact the pike up there will swipe at a gym sock. Still, it goes on to say, "It was only after I had become almost a blood brother to an Indian guide that I found out how. They were using a crudely carved and painted wooden duckling with hooks attached. Zabo even guaranteed success with your Cree duck in the ad and offered a full refund within 10 days if you weren't satisfied." I cannot help but wonder how many refunds he gave, because I have never been satisfied with the duckling lore. Not once, ever, and in my opinion, they fall squarely in the novelty category. Not only have I never caught a fish on one, I've never seen a live duckling get snatched in person. I want to see it. I think we all want to see it, and love the idea of a pike or muskie or bass that sucks living fowl off the surface. And that's why I think duckling lore is sold back in the day and continue to sell now. Though duckling sort of faded away in the 80s and 90s, companies like Savage Gear recently resurrected them. If you fish and are on social media, strong chance you caught that fairly recent video of a kayak angler nailing a monster pike on a buzzing Savage Gear suicide duck. Search for ducklings getting eaten by fish on YouTube and you'll find plenty of clips. Nobody, including me, ever said it doesn't happen or never happens. In fact, I also know there are certain lakes in Canada that basically have a yearly duckling hatch, and the pike gobble them up like Tic Tacs. But I call bullshit on the idea that a duckling is some sort of secret weapon everywhere. The way I look at them, if you throw it long enough, eventually something's going to clobber it. The massive Instagram attention you'd get from the shot might be worth it to some, but I haven't the patience to throw a lure I have no confidence in for more than 20 minutes, and I will quickly opt for something I know the fish eat on a regular basis. My colleague and buddy, Sam Lundgren, Meat Eater's fishing editor, echoes my feelings. But then there was a musky trip he took with his dad on the Flambeau in 2018. Immediately after his old man caught his first ever musky, he cut off the whopper plopper that it trashed and tied on one of them newfangled suicide ducks. Sam scoffed. And I get the impression he was mildly embarrassed in front of their guide. Few casts in, though, that duck got hammered by a 40-plus incher, which might not have gone over so well considering Sam was working really hard on that trip to get one on fly. And as Sam put it, "My dad fished that damn lure for the next day and a half without so much as a passing glance." Did that fish really identify that as a duckling, or did it just make the right sound and get in front of a fish that was ready to kill? We'll never know, even though I think you know what I think. And Sam, I do hope your dad gleaned all the Insta love he could out of those photos.
Well, that's all we have for you today. But if your New Year's resolution was to start scrapbooking, like I know Joe's was, this week's page would include the worst use yet for fly reels. Further proof that anglers are either illiterate, brilliant, or some combination of both. A Cinderella story of inspiration for all the pimply fat kids out there fondling their Zebcos, and possibly the best, worst lure ever invented.
Oh my God, terrific. As always, send us a note and let us know what you're up to at bent@themeateater.com. We look forward to all your news ideas, bar nominations, sale bin items, awkward photos, love letters, and unmitigated hate mail.
Yeah, we do. To be fair, most of those are for Lance V. No matter what you have to say, we will read it. And if you make us laugh, we'll be sure to send a Degenerate Angler sticker your way. Just be sure to send us your address, too.
That's right. We're also keeping an eye on the Degenerate Angler and Bent podcast hashtags. If you're into the whole gram thing, But remember, even if you're like Miles and hate social media, you're always welcome here.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.